Hello and welcome to the latest Brewing podcast. After another busy week in politics, on this recording, we decide to alternate the focus back to investment. Difficult though Brexit is to avoid entirely, our main points of discussion today are the merits of growth investing relative to value, a debate which continues to rage in investment circles, as well as a look at some specific companies that fall into the growth category, such as Spirax, Sarco, and YouGov. We do so in the company of our esteemed guest, Anthony Cross, a fund manager at Lion Trust Asset Management. We're sure you'll enjoy the conversation, but first, please listen to our important disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Research Director here at Brewin Dolphin, and today we're going to be looking at UK equities, and we're going to be doing so with one of the leading names from asset management, although I'm sure he's too modest to recognise that moniker, Anthony Cross of Lion Trust. Anthony and his team manage a host of global funds, but UK equity funds we'll be looking at today, Special Situations, the Small Cap Fund, UK Growth and a Micro Cap Strategy. And we want to look at some of the investment decisions that you've been taken, I guess sort of predominantly in the Special Situations Fund that we're most focused on, Anthony. But I know your investment process underpins that range of products that you manage. And as a sort of a teaser, I know we want to talk about some macro themes that you think are very important that clients need to consider, and how government may evolve its policy to tackle the challenges that are out there at the moment. So a bit of a broad brush. A tease there, but let's begin, Anthony, then with you describing, please, your sort of investment approach that can help clients understand how you tackle UK equities.
Yeah, so our investment approach is all about the importance of intangible assets, intellectual capital. And our argument is that these intangible assets, such as intellectual property, distribution networks, customer relationships, and brands, have become so important in companies that they create for those businesses very strong barriers to competition, pricing power, and the ability to get into those sort of companies that will then give us long-term compounding of returns. So intellectual capital has become more important for two reasons. One is that technology is a big driver of pieces of intellectual capital. So the ability to use data and to harvest the returns from data, the use of software in developing businesses and taking businesses to a global scale. So technology has been a very big driver, and also globalization has been a very big driver. So what we've found with companies which are, say, rich in intellectual property, say an engineering company, is that they've been able to take their intellectual capital, their intellectual property, and take it around the world. So when I started investing over 20 years ago, an engineering business might be mainly UK focused with a bit into Europe and a bit into the US, but now they are truly global businesses as markets have opened up in Asia and Latin America and in the old Soviet bloc. So lots of intellectual capital assets mean that companies now have terrific pricing power and the ability to go global. And those are the sort of companies that we hunt for. Once we're happy that they have either a strength in distribution, recurring income, or intellectual property, we'll then look at their returns on invested capital. Because if our idea is right that they have pricing power and margin strength, they should be able to achieve high returns on invested capital. And we use a return on capital measure to look at our companies to see whether they are truly value creators and creating those excess returns that can then get reinvested back into the business to go on with the compounding that we really seek for the long term.
Now, there will be this investment approach, some may perhaps incorrectly, sort of just quickly label and throw into this sort of growth bucket, which has had a tremendous sort of tailwind for it, and you've been able to sort of capture in your fund range. It's come under a bit of pressure sort of recently. There's a lot of conversations about growth rotation into value. I mean, you're a long-term investor for sure, but I wonder whether you have any comment on this sort of style rotation and your vulnerability to it, and whether you think it's something that you're sort of nervous about.
Yeah, so over my investment career, there have been periods where there has been rallies in what one might call value stocks, and growth stocks will underperform. Sometimes those have gone on for a few months, and then the longest period I can remember is halfway through 2012 and all of 2013. So that was a kind of 18-month period of a value rally. What tends to occur with value rallies is that they have an underpinning of better economic times. Because if investors want to go in and buy, let's say, house building companies, construction companies, or retailers, typically areas where there is greater value in the stock market, value investors feel more comfortable doing that if they know that the economy is getting better and the base case of profitability of these companies should improve. So whilst at the moment one is going through or has gone through a period of value outperforming growth, my worry, if I were a value investor, would be about the general strength of the global economy, which in areas looks a bit weak. We've seen potential weakness in terms of slowing growth in the US. You've seen difficulties in Europe, and particularly in the German economy. And then overlaying that as well, you've got issues to do with Chinese growth and tariffs and Brexit. So the backdrop for value investing, I think, is quite tough in terms of the outlook for profitability of companies. So I would be kind of nervous. But if there is to be a value rally and a sustained value rally, that is more tricky for our style. We are naturally in businesses which have got the barriers to competition. They're growth style businesses. They will tend to be more highly valued than the average in the stock market, and for good reasons, because they're better compounding businesses. But if there is a style rotation, we've always been very clear that we will tend to underperform the cyclical rally. And for however long that goes on, it tends to create quite a headwind for our style. We tend to outperform when you're in a much more steady state economy, where the economy is growing, where companies are being rewarded for delivery, because that's what our companies tend to do. And then we also tend to outperform in the opposite of a cyclical rally, when everyone's really worried about life and the stock market is falling.
Now, when it comes to UK equities, it's hard not to sort of bring up the subject of Brexit. It would be unfair of me to ask you to predict, you know, what happens next, but I'll be interested. I know you have a view on how this sort of political outcome has materialised and the decisions that governments may have to make in response, and not just in terms of trade deals and borders on the island of Ireland, etc. But this is actual sort of distribution of wealth, isn't it?
Yeah. I think from my passion for looking at intellectual capital and intangible assets, I think there's an interesting story around perhaps the reasons for Brexit. And some of what I'm going to chat about has come from a very interesting book called Capitalism Without Capital. So for your listeners, it's a great book to read, I think. And as we started our conversation, we talked about intangible assets. Well, of course, there are tangible assets like plant and machinery and stocks. And those tangible assets, used to dominate the economy. But you've seen the rise of intangible assets that we've talked about, like intellectual property and distribution networks and brands and customer relationships. And driven by technology and globalization, companies that have these intangible assets have become much more powerful. They've become super companies and are generating very high returns. And what naturally happens with super companies is they attract other super companies that will come and work near them. And they will be also supported by finance and lawyers. And you end up with economic clusters. So a big scale cluster is the Southeast. But within the Southeast, you'll have places like Cambridge, where you've got clusters of technology companies going on, and they're supported by the university and research and development budgets. AstraZeneca has moved there. Then there'll be finance people and lawyers will be moving there. So you have a very prosperous cluster. And the people who work in those companies are highly paid, they are outward looking, they are global, and they generally are people who, with their outward looking nature, vote Remain. So 75% of Cambridge voted for Remain. Now, the flip side of that, away from the clusters, are the much more depressed areas, more inward looking, more nostalgic. People are working in businesses where there is not much pricing power, there's not a lot of intellectual capital. Wage rates can't be that high because they can't afford to pay people that much. There's lots of competition. There's immigrant labour, which is creates, again, competitive pressure on wages. People feel unloved. There's low self-esteem. And you could take a place like Boston, where in Lincolnshire, where the major part of the economy is in food processing, 75% of Boston voted to leave. So you've got these big splits in the country between the dynamic, exciting, buzzing clusters and the more inward-looking, depressed areas where they feel left behind and they want to take back control of their lives and how things used to be. And the big issue for government is how do you try and knit these areas, the clusters and the depressed areas, back together again more? You know, in the old days, people who used to own lots of tangible assets like mines and farms and factories used to live amongst their communities. Now wealthy people don't have to. They go and live in the clusters. They go and live in the dynamic, exciting cities. So you've got to knit these areas back together again, culturally and economically. And the government will have to put more into infrastructure. Government will have to move some of their own departments into these areas to try and bring more wealth into those areas. They've got to invest in technology. They've got to invest in education. But also what I think will come down the tracks, and this is obviously very important for your client base, is how do you engineer the wealth redistribution? And I think there will be some. And one of the things I think will occur is the cloak of climate change, which is obviously a genuine issue, but it will be used to engineer greater wealth taxes. So it might be taxes on property, it might be taxes on antisocial cars or boats or whatever wealthy people want to enjoy. You can really get in and tax those things under the cloak of that it's good for the environment and it's good for climate change, that those excesses, those luxuries that wealthy people tend to enjoy, you know, air travel and second homes, will get taxed much more heavily. And that's a way you can start to redistribute wealth, as I say, under the cloak of climate change.
And does that at all sort of impact the way you think about investments? I mean, I would be concerned that perhaps those in power with a sort of a centre-left orientation may be looking to tax some of these winning businesses that you have backed and have done so well for your funds and clients.
That is a danger. I mean, that is a worry. There's a real danger that you end up sort of killing the golden goose. So the clusters are highly successful. I mean, you know, if you look at the southeast of England, it's one of the most dynamic areas in the whole of Europe. The amount of technology investment that's coming into the UK is very strong. We've got a lot of strong investment in technology companies and some of the best growth rates in technology in the whole of Europe. And the danger is, as you say, you get a centre-left government come in and they want to put in taxes that start to impinge upon...
Well, there isn't much sign of a centre-left government. I was a bit generous there.
Well, centre-left-left. Yeah, no, there is a real danger of that. And, you know, some of what you hear the Labour Party talk about this week in their conference about, you know, redistribution and shorter working weeks and, you know, ultimately, who pays for that will be the wealthier companies, and that's where it will come from.
Okay, well, that's fascinating. Let's come back to some investment decisions you've taken. For example, you've got a business like Spirax Sarco. I mean, Some of our listeners may be less familiar with that enterprise. You might sort of think, well, you've just been talking about intellectual capital, and this is just sort of an engineering sort of pump maker. Perhaps it's dishing out sort of commoditized products. Why has this got barriers to entry, this business?
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating business, and it's what I like to call the quiet compounder in the market. And there's nothing better than finding a business that just quietly gets on with it, and it's not creating loads of headlines and overexcitement. It just quietly delivers. So it's a company that was founded in the 1880s, so it's got some history to it. Been around a while. It listed on the London market in 1959, and it's grown its dividend.
Have you owned it since then? No. Of course, that's a very cruel joke, Andy Carroll.
It listed in 1959 and has compounded its dividend, grown its dividend every year. So it really has delivered. Yes, it's an engineering business, but it's an engineering business with strong intellectual property. So they're spending about 5% of sales every year on research and development, and the amount they've spent on research and development has doubled since 2008. It's a business with a very strong distribution network, so it's now representative in over 100 countries, and it has over 100,000 customers and 300,000 stock-keeping units. So this is a business of scale, and a business of complexity, and a business of intellectual property, but also a business of close customer relationships. And they have over 1,300 specialist engineers out in the field who sell to customers solutions. So it's a solutions-based sale.
So the engineers are the salespeople, are they?
Yeah.
So a real knowledge of what their clients' needs are then.
I guess. So they're not just a chit-chat merchant with a pamphlet. They know their stuff. And they'll be in the factories helping the customers with their pumps, which is part of peristaltic pumps, is part of the business. But the main part of Spirax Sarco is to do with the steam loop. So steam is used in a lot of industrial processes, from heating to cooling to purification, through to being a driving force within an industrial process. So they're selling solutions, and they're selling improvements and upgrades and energy efficiencies. So it is very much an engineering solutions-based sale, which means then that you're very embedded within your end customers and you have a very close relationship with them. So for us, it's a great story about intellectual capital, intellectual property, distribution, customer relationships, and it's built a strong brand within their industry. And it achieves high returns on invested capital. So you're back to that virtuous circle again, whereby you are creating excess returns, you reinvest those back in the business, you open up in new territories, and you could just keep quietly compounding away. So a lovely example of a British engineering business doing well, but not with great trumpets and fanfares, but just quietly delivering and compounding and growing dividends.
And you don't feel like you're paying too much for it at this sort of current levels?
Yeah, it's quite an expensive business.
I say that actually, it's sort of it's come off a little bit recently, hasn't it? It's had some troubles with its European acquisition. Is that right?
There was a bit of indigestion with an acquisition, but I think that's not really the main issue which hit the price. Because I think actually, what's a bigger concern is the global concern. So it's not a Spirax Sarco specific concern, but they are a terrific bellwether for global economic activity. And they have said that in line with global industrial activity, life is a little bit quieter than it was, say, 6, 9, 12 months ago. And we're seeing that right across the piece. I think things are definitely more difficult globally now than they were 12 months ago, which, back to our earlier conversation about value rallies, makes me question how long a value rally can go on for if the economic background is a bit tougher.
So just to square that, because if it's a bellwether for global activity, yet it's not suggests it has some cyclical sensitivity, but you're looking at secular growth stories predominantly. So how is that sort of somewhat contradictory?
Yeah, it's what we would call a sort of gentle cyclical business.
Right, okay.
In that over half their sales come out of the operational budgets of their end customers. So upgrades, small purchases, wear and tear type budget, 50% of their sales. The rest comes through capital expenditure budgets, where companies are upgrading plant building new plant. So compared to some engineers, it is not too cyclical, but it has cyclicality in it, like most companies do. Our approach when running the fund is that we have kind of balance of businesses. So yes, we have engineers, some more cyclical than others, but we also have healthcare companies. We have the big consumer goods companies like Unilever and Diageo. We have high recurring income software businesses, and we have some of the big global service companies. So we have a kind of mix of businesses within the fund, but overall the fund tends to be much less cyclical than the overall market because we don't find intellectual capital in often cyclical areas like building and construction, retailing, and areas like leisure and mining and retail banking. So we tend to, we're never relaxed. It's a game where you're always wanting to perform and do better than others. But we know with the type of fund that we've got that we tend to be in more dependable businesses than the average in the stock market. So it's the blend that we have in the fund, and therefore we are comfortable owning businesses that might be about to have a more cyclical time.
Okay, well, let's look at some other names in the portfolio. I mean, you mentioned the brands. Actually, we talk a lot about Unilever and Diageo, and I'm sure you've got lots of valuable things to say on those companies. But let's look at something that's perhaps less well seen in portfolios, but a name like YouGov, I think people will be pretty familiar with the brand. And I believe it was a stock that entered into your microcap fund, was a success, and now is in other bigger some of your bigger strategies. But I mean, what is the what is the revenue? What is the business model? Sorry, YouGov. We all know about the survey, but what is the business model for YouGov?
So people tend to think of YouGov as a political polling business, and in some ways that's how it kind of built its brand. But the vast majority of its business, the profitable part of its business, is much more in consumer research, consumer polling, and the business was very much born out of the internet and digital data. So in the old days, as we all know, polling used to be telephone polling or people standing around with clipboards outside train stations asking boring questions. But what YouGov have done is they've built a panel, and a big panel, which is all done digitally. And they build up data from the panel. And the power of the research and the power of the digital connections they have then into their customer base means that their customers, like the likes of Unilever, can instantaneously find out thoughts and insights on their products. So it's fast research. They can within the database that YouGov have, they can knit together their own research by configuring the panel answers to how they want to approach the question.
So is it getting sort of displaced at all by sort of feedback that Facebook may be able to provide to a business wanting advertising space? If a product gets lots of likes, mm-hmm. is that more valuable than a YouGov survey, or are they sort of complementary? Or
I think they're complementary. YouGov goes into greater depth. And the key to a lot of these market research databases is the history behind it. So something like YouGov has built up terrific amount of data and insight, and been able to, in a sense, prove to their clients that the insights that they provide are valuable and work. And it's therefore, it's a lot of it's about credibility. And so, Facebook might build up a credible product, but something like YouGov has got proven expertise in doing it.
Is there any sort of examples of how YouGov has helped a business sort of succeed, or is it all sort of very much marginal sort of contributions that help build a bigger picture on how they need to evolve their brand or something?
I think it's more marginal. I mean, they no doubt they will have examples that
they roll out
where they're out pitching for business. But it's more about the sort of the marginal continual insights of how brands are building. So how Unilever's brands are building in the marketplace, or Diageo's brands are building in the marketplace. But the key is for us is that it's a mixture of the intellectual property that YouGov have built up, but also the embedded distribution. That's what we love, is the fact that this the data that they provide their end customers becomes very much embedded and ingrained within their decision-making and how they go about doing their business. So in some ways, back to your Facebook point, yes, somebody like Facebook might come along with an alternative product, but whilst YouGov's is really good and embedded within their customer, the customer will be quite loath to move because they've built up this deep relationship. And in effect, it becomes very sticky, embedded within the end customer. We think that's a very valuable part of these data-rich businesses. They become kind of mission-critical, part of their customers' methods of doing business.
And you own another business, Global Data. Is it broadly similar?
It's less sort
in its
of,
utility, but
yeah, it's less kind of. It's much more market research into product categories. So they'll be, for example, in the drinks business, they'll be doing lots of market research into not necessarily opinions, but into competitor products, market shares of competitor products, market shares of their customers' products, insight into how markets are changing, insight into where the growth markets are in the world. So much more sort of strategic planning type market research as opposed to necessarily brand building market research.
Okay, well, I'll sort of close out with a very unfair question, which is going to be disguised to look, you know, relatively intellectual, but basically I'm asking you, you know, what are your returns going to be going forward? But what I want to get a sense of is, you know, the level of optimism as you sort of sit here today looking at your fund, given sort of global conditions, the challenges you talked about in the political sphere and the style rotation, lots and lots of variables, but just want to get a sense of, you know, levels of optimism about what these funds can do from here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a passionate believer in the process and the style, the types of companies we look for. You know, I think if you're finding companies with lots of intellectual property and strong distribution networks and deep customer relationships and brands, good margins, pricing power, compounding ability, it's a great way to invest in a great place to park your money. Now, throughout my 20 odd years of on our land trust funds, and I've worked obviously at Schroders before that, you know, I've seen ups and downs and crises and tech booms and busts and biotech booms and busts and lots of things going on. There's always worries and there's always concerns and there's, you know, there's always potential political upsets. But I'm a great believer in the power of businesses and equity and building of companies and the power of compounding and man's ingenuity. And I, you know, there's a lot of concerns, obviously, about genuine concerns about climate change. But, you know, in some ways, there's an opportunity and there will be businesses that will come out of that. And there's the great hunting ground of small companies, which you can build into an all-cap product like the Special Sits Fund, I think is hugely valuable. And we've got our microcap fund hunting for new ideas. We've got the smaller companies fund as well, generating new ideas that can then go into the Special Situations Fund. So as we saw with YouGov. And I think that, I think the outlook for equities in the long term is fantastic and the compounding ability of fast growing businesses is great. Pound cost average into funds. Don't take great views on stock market levels or politics, but just keep chipping away, putting little bits of your savings into equity funds with a strong process. And I think, you know, over a 10, 20 year view, you'll look back and say, that was a fantastic thing to do.
Okay, great. Well, a very rational, believable, but optimistic view there. And in fact, it's remarkable, actually, we had a rather sort of downbeat podcast last week on bonds, but it's remarkable how much I think you would agree that there are sort of challenges out there and actually quality businesses can still do a great thing for clients, even at today's sort of seemingly richer valuations. But Anthony, thanks very much for a fascinating conversation. For our listeners, thanks very much for listening and joining us. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Brewin Podcast, or leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud, but whatever platform you listen to us through. We hope you enjoyed it, and we look forward to bringing you another update next week.